everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Mobilecast. We are here with season three. Yes, this is the third season of the Mobilecast, and we're actually trying something a little bit different. So we're going to do a roundtable today. I brought three of my friends on, and it's going to sort of be a free-form discussion. I have a couple topics, but we're going to see what happens. So for the first episode of the third season, my three guests are Brett Belding, Swarna Padilla, and Philippe Winthrop. So Brett, introduce yourself, then Swarna, then Philippe.
Thanks, Brian. Hi, everybody. I'm Brett Belding. I run end-user compute consulting for Dimension Data here in the Americas. Thanks for having me on.
Swarna.
Okay. I'm Swarna Padilla, and I am probably, this will be my last mobile hurrah. I am leaving the mobile world or mobile security world and heading into the networking world. Well, not really social networking, but technical networking technology world. I am at Avi Networks. So I start my gig at Avi Networks. Probably by the time this podcast is published, I will already be there.
So everybody understands, we're recording this on a Tuesday, but we're going to be releasing this next Monday on the first day of MWC. So Swarna doesn't actually start her job till tomorrow, but congratulations. That is huge news. Very excited for you.
And thank you very much.
You're welcome. Philippe, introduce yourself.
So if this is going to be released during Mobile World Congress, hola, soy Philippe Winthrop. Yo soy el líder de estrategia de móvil a la empresa CSC.
And in English for those of us who can't speak Spanish?
Hello, everybody. This is Philippe Winthrop. I am the global lead mobility strategist at CSC.
Cool.
Did that to show off.
Well, of course he did. Just don't give him a chance. He'll start speaking in French too.
¿Dónde está la biblioteca?
So he wants to know where the library is. That may be, you know, that and maybe a few other phrases are about all he knows. But we'll leave it at that.
Brian, so, I think you know better than that.
Philippe, shouldn't you be drinking? It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Yeah, it is 5 o'clock in Nova Scotia.
So, Swarna, I'm actually going to start with you since you are actually leaving the mobile security world, but you've been in the mobile world for a few years now, more than a few years. And our first topic, since this is released on day one of MWC, is actually, what do you think we might see or what do you expect from MWC? And I know that you've been to the last three Mobile World Congresses, Swarna. So why don't you start? And Brett, Philippe, feel free to jump in when you're ready.
Okay. I think the first biggest thing that we should all expect in Mobile World Congress is a bunch of tapas and free-flowing sangria. So, of course, that will be there. But if you talk about the show floor, then I think from what at least I've seen in the last few years of mobile security trends, the focus on identity is definitely shifting significantly heavily. And with that also comes the Internet of Things. Of course, the industrial Internet of Things is slowly expanding. And while enterprise is not there yet, I think we will also see significant IoT movement in the enterprises as well, probably as more emerging trends or something that is probably fostered as a pet project in many enterprises, or at least enterprises that are ahead of the technology curve. So we will probably see much more of that and a lot of consumer-related wearables, consumer-focused devices that are smart connected things that are slowly crossing the chasm from consumer to enterprise.
And are you gonna miss not being at being at MWC this year, Swarna?
As much as I would love to say that I would hate to be in Barcelona during MWC, but I think, yes, I will definitely miss all the fun and all the fun updates that I will also see in the Mobile World Congress. It's a huge event and it's a lot of fun. It's exhausting, but it's also a lot of fun because you get to see so many cool new technologies that are being launched or unveiled at the event.
Well, you know, Swarna, the reality is I'm sure you'll be able to live it in real time, given that Brian undoubtedly will be tweeting about 10,000 times a day.
Yes, I do promise to tweet some things, including the fact that without even looking, I know Samsung's going to release some devices. I know that Huawei's going to release some devices. I know that there are going to be more devices than I can shake a stick at. There's going to be the China Hall where you can walk down and see unbelievable amounts of different devices from different people that all look the same, that are all Android. Mm-hmm.
Well, fundamentally, every smartphone is a piece of glass and a battery, so it's not like they look that different anyway. It just depends on where you put the fingerprint reader. Well, I think the biggest thing in Mobile World Congress that hardly anyone's talking about is 5G, whatever that means, because you know what happened with 4G. But AT&T and Verizon have already made some comments about it, and I suspect that given this is traditionally a carrier show, that they're going to talk more about how do you get to gigabit over the air. Because once you get gigabit over the air, then you have actual broadband competition, right? Like you can do U.S. broadband competition in places where AT&T or Verizon or whoever doesn't have cable on the ground.
Yeah, but I guess one of the things about 5G is 5G really isn't meant for people. You know, if you look at what the carriers are talking about, a lot of 5G is more for devices and intercommunication versus giving people gigabits of download space.
Right. It's as much about, from a consumer perspective, it sounds great to say you're going to have so much more speed, but the reality is that the 5G network is going to have a lot more scalability, and it's going to be the dawn of IoT, right? But the reality is, don't forget, guys, that AT&T is hoping to have a real-world consumer usable 5G in 2020. So we're still in the hype phase.
Well, of course we're in the hype phase, and yet it's one of the big topics of MWC. So we expect to see it there.
Yeah, and I think Swanner is right. On the other end is the more it is we'll just watch everything become connected. And you saw some of that at CES. People are trying to connect pretty much everything. And so what I find really interesting is the intersection of the connected things and the topic we had at the last mobile bit or future bit sweet chat around AI. Mm. So,
which is actually a later topic, but that leads me to a question for everybody here, because everybody here on this call has done some work in their home in the last 2 years. Philippe, I know you're redoing your place. Swarna, you just finished your place. And Brett, I've been to your place, which you've redone. So how many connected devices do each of you actually have in your house, and what are they?
Define device.
You define device. You're answering the question.
Well, okay. Is a device – are you talking about things with IP addresses or things with Bluetooth radios or both?
Things you can talk to that talk
define
to each other.
Talk.
So,
like,
then I'll start. I have two smart TVs. I also have a bunch of Nest thermostats. I also have two Carrier thermostats because I have baseboard hot water, and I also have Carrier air conditioners outside that are 5-stage that the Nest couldn't handle. I have Alexa coming, the Amazon Echo coming. I have my garage door opener can talk. And so at the top of my head, that's all the things that I have. I can talk. I can control them all from my phone or from my computer. I can turn things on and off, and actually my alarm system.
So I've got three laptops, a NAS server, two tablets, four smartphones, two clock radios that are Wi-Fi only.
So what can they do? What can your Wi-Fi radios do, clock radios do?
So what they can do is not only can they go to Pandora, they can also go on to the – I don't even know what the protocol is technically called, but being able to go on to any radio provider who has a stream. So I love listening to the French news. And so I've got a preset now on my clock radio for Europe 1, which is one of the French radio stations. So that's kind of neat.
Do you say, Philippe, just as a side note, do you still listen to French news with all the amount of time you spend watching the Republican debates? I think we're almost as fun.
Well, again, it's pick your comedy. It just so happens that I can understand comedy and various languages. So yes, it's as in one is as fun as the other. Smart TV, so I can do Amazon video on that. Just installed today, two of my four Echo B3s. So that's kind of neat. I think I've got like 20 IP addresses on my network right now, which is ridiculous for two adults and a almost three-year-old. But no, it is what it is.
Swarna, what do you have that's smart in your house besides your two beautiful children?
And me. You forget me. Apart from the...
I notice you don't mention your husband there, but we'll leave that.
Okay, moving along. Apart from the smartphones, tablets, and the watches, I think we also, and the laptops, we also have two smart TVs, our sound system, our alarm system, our nanny cam kind of camera, our thermostats, the Honeywell thermostats. What else? Thinking, what else? I think that's at least some of the things that I can think of that are connected or that can talk to each other. We are also considering probably the doorbell, the Ring doorbell. I'm just starting to kind of look for reviews, feedback on it, and see if we need to install that as well. But yeah, pretty much everything can talk to each other.
Brett?
So I just did a network scan while you guys were talking. So there are 25 devices with an IP address on my home wireless at the moment. That doesn't include everything because my wife and the kids are out, which means they both have their iPads. So there's probably 30 things in the house that are IP enabled, plus the Bluetooth only stuff like my watch and the speakers and all that. That the connected, like specifically non-traditional connected stuff, we have three smart TVs. Ironically, though, I don't really use the smart part. Like they're just a glass panel. There's just a TV. Because the TVs also have, we have two receivers. Both receivers are IP enabled. They have apps on them. And then plugged into that are Chromecast and Apple TV and all the little sticks and stuff. I've got three Nest, one for each floor. I'm shopping for the garage door opener, so I'm curious to know if you like yours or not. And what else? Oh, and I'm also looking at the doorbell thing as well.
I'll tell you my issue with the... with the garage door openers, and right now I think it's true of any of them, getting the device to learn the garage door opener piece just is horrible. Yeah. If you've ever tried to do home link in your car, it's pretty much the same thing, and it just sucks. And you'd think that garage door openers could do better, and it doesn't. It also requires a hardline Ethernet drop, which kills me too. So
really? Wow, yeah. I didn't know that. That is not
what's
good.
Wrong with having a hardline Ethernet drop as part of what we're doing. In our reno, we're going to run we are running Cat 6 so that we can have gigabit Ethernet because as good as 802. So, and by the way, our Wi-Fi is 802.11ac. And as good as that is, a gigabit switch is going to have lower latency and less dropped bits. It still has merit.
Yeah, but to be fair, yeah. I'm certainly not going to run Ethernet to my garage. My house was already built when I moved into it. Yeah. But I look at it and I say, it would be nice, since it's running wireless from the garage door opener to the device, if the device also was wireless. And that's the part that I find annoying.
Or if it could do power line over Ethernet built in or something similar. Because everyone has power for garage door opener.
And I think what this leads to is the next topic. I'm sorry, Philippe, to interrupt. What you're talking about is how do we make these smart home devices easier for the consumer? And I think that what you're talking about as far as built-in networking. So if you need Ethernet, give us power line. We know we have to plug these devices in. Yes, it costs a little bit more, but you might sell more if you could deploy them in more places. But it gets to the network ubiquity and how hard it is to get some of these things to run. Philippe, you were going to say something?
Well, my comment was going to be actually a question is I haven't even yet looked. I mean, these two Echo Bees that I have been installed for less than 90 minutes. So I haven't even looked at the instruction manual. It, not because I need to learn how to use it via the instruction manual, but just to look more at the technical specs around what version of Wi-Fi these things are using, right? Whether it's B, G, N, whatever. But to your question, I mean, how expensive is it now to get an 802.11n at 2.4 gigahertz chip in some piece of silicon? I mean, it's peanuts. I mean, I can't imagine. I think it's more a question of the people who are creating these things who don't fully appreciate the user base that they are addressing. I mean, look at other than Nest or Ecobee, and those are technology companies. When you've got a thermostat built by Carrier, right, or by Honeywell or whomever, those are companies whose DNA is based upon HVAC and not on technology, right? It's the classic case of Uber, right? Uber is not a livery service. It's an app platform with logistics around it, right? They took the opposite approach, and that's what I think needs to happen, is that for these tools or components to really be home-friendly and ubiquitous is that they typically have to take the opposite approach and not think of it as a garage door opener, but rather a consumer-friendly connected device that's going to have an app with it that just so happens to open your garage door.
Yeah, I think to your point, it's interesting about the thermostats, because up until the Nest, I never installed my own thermostat, right? I never had to change one. It was just there and it made the temperature whatever I told it to, and that was it, right? End of. The Nest was the first one that, to your point, right, they purposely built it so that you as an end user could install it, right? They have all the little labels and the little punch outs and all the colors and the screwdriver. I mean, everything is in the box. It is as easy as it possibly can be. And that's where you need to be, right? And this the necessity for wired connection is interesting. I just bought two new TiVos about a month ago, the new TiVo Bolt and a Mini. And I found out in the box that in order for the TiVo Mini to talk to the brand new TiVo Bolt, like brand new product, it can't use wireless. So either it sets up a MoCA network over your coax cable, or you have to plug it in to a wired Ethernet connection.
Yeah, but what's impressive about it, and that goes back to my earlier point, it can set up its own MoCA network.
Right. But why? I'm sure there's some reason, but why in 2016, when you release a brand new product, why are you still relying on physical media? Like, we should be past that. Although, to Philippe's point earlier, I bought a new Apple TV over for Christmas, and it is literally sitting next to my AirPort Extreme, and yet I have it cabled. So it does 802.11ac at 1300 megabytes. So it's actually faster wireless than it is wired, but I plugged it in anyway, even though the Apple TV 4 has a 10100 jack. It still has a 10100 jack.
I was just about to say that. That is absolutely ridiculous that jack is 10100. And by the way, if you can get yours to run at 1300, let's talk offline, because I can only get mine to talk at 867.
Yeah, so my new MacBook Pro, about 15 feet away from it, I'll do 1300.
Jesus.
But that's the thing. But so my internet connection at the moment is 85 meg down. So 100 meg NIC doesn't really make a difference right now. But if Comcast decides to give me any more than 100 megabit down, the jack in the back of my brand new Apple TV is going to be the limiting factor on the speed of the device.
Yeah, but the truth of the matter is, what are you going to stream? Even if you're streaming 4K or 8K TV, which your Apple TV can't display at the moment, what are you going to stream that's going to take all that bandwidth? What really matters is all the devices you have hooked up that are sucking bandwidth down at the same time, and some devices that we all have that sometimes suck up all the bandwidth and kill the other devices.
It's more than that. It's the latency.
It's more, yeah.
I want to give Swarna a chance to jump in here, though. She's been a little quiet the last couple of minutes.
But it is the latency, right? It's about being able to I purchase a fair number of movies off of iTunes, and I can pull them off my NAS almost instantaneously. But if for whatever reason I don't have my computer on and I want to just stream it from iTunes, there's still a good 5 to 10 second latency in getting the thing going. And my ADHD is just can't tolerate that.
And forget about the ADHD or the streaming movies. If I am streaming a 4K movie on my Samsung Smart TV, then I cannot have a decent quality call on my VoIP phone. That's as ridiculous as it gets, because it's just the limitations on the network that just limits it. Because when I am streaming from Netflix on my a 4K Netflix movie, I expect to have at least one other device that is connected to have another similar activity going on. If I have to shut everything down because I have to stream a 4K movie, then it doesn't make any sense buying a 4K TV. And I just have the same issue with the Comcast as well, that if I am running a Netflix movie, forget about even not even 4K, if I'm just running a Netflix movie on my laptop, I will probably have an awful call quality on my Vonage phone.
Yeah, you know, I can relate since I'm, you know, I use Optimum Online, so I'm not Comcast, thankfully. And I have to say, Optimum does a very, very good job. On the other hand, I do have a voice over IP phone, and every now and then the quality cuts out. And, you know, it's hasn't QoS been around for like 20 years or something?
Yeah, but that's also a question of the router, right? So I have an Apple Extreme AC router, and I have no QoS capabilities.
Yeah, but yeah, but you know what? This should be Brett's to answer. He worked at Cisco. He should be able to answer this question with his eyes closed.
So QoS over the internet is nearly impossible to do, right? Like everybody's tried it. No one succeeded because packets go everywhere. And so it's a very difficult thing to do unless you own the whole network. And Netflix doesn't own a network, right? They don't even own a data center. They're out of the data centers now. So they don't own any infrastructure. They just do content deals. So so to your point, though, what I find really interesting is the brand new Apple TV 4, the experience on it is night and day from the old one. And that's not any of the App Store or any of that stuff. It's the fact that it's so fast and the fact that it caches so quickly. So when I go into Netflix and I hit play, the movie starts immediately. When I go into the ESPN app, it plays as soon as I'm in the app, it starts playing something. And that is a function of the device going quickly and it being able to buffer as fast as it possibly can so that it looks like it's regular TV off of a coax cable and not streaming video, right? And so you can see why Apple said that the Apple TV, the new one, is the future of television because they've effectively eliminated that buffer time, but it's in 1080. So you can expect that the next Apple TV will be in 4K and probably will have an Ethernet or a gigabit jack so that it can have that same exact experience. But it's night and day. If you haven't played with one yet, it's truly different. You can tell it feels like regular TV, and that's pretty amazing.
Okay, so let's change. I think this has been a great subject, but you know, I want to switch topics here, and I want to hit Philippe a little bit where it hurts.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Philippe. You still are a huge fan of Windows Phone. And yet, hang
not
on.
True. Not
and,
true.
And yet, you no longer use a Windows Phone.
Correct.
And, you know, we have a diverse group of people here. I know I've owned both Apple and Android and actually Windows Phone as well. Brett, I know you've owned both. Swarna, I know you've owned Apple. I don't know if you've owned an Android.
No, I'm a huge Apple fan.
So, huge Apple fan. And, you know, we look at Windows Phone and we look at where Microsoft's going, what it's done. So I kind of just wanted to hop on this topic of, I think we can all agree Windows Phone is dead, even though they just released a 650. Any disagreement there?
Well, don't forget, the Windows Phone is dead, but the platform is now obviously Windows 10 Mobile.
Okay. Are you planning on going when they come out with – if they ever come out with a Surface Phone, are you planning on going back, Philippe?
So here's the deal. When I
– That was a yes or no question.
No, it's not. It's actually – when I actually made the switch right – the week before Thanksgiving, I went from a crappy Nokia 640 to I went big as opposed to going home. So iPhone 6s Plus, 128 gig.
What happened to your Lumia 1530 or 1520?
1520. The main microphone died, and I just got tired of all sorts of other bugs with it. What frustrates me the most about my new iPhone is the fact that I don't have to either soft reset or hard reset it every day. I hate the fact that the apps actually work. I hate the fact that the call quality is good and that my touchscreen, you know, doesn't flake on me. It's maddening that all those things actually work.
So you don't like stability.
I hate that. I hate it. Because those were the most fun parts of my experience with my 640 running a preview version an insider build of Windows 10 Mobile.
But even your 1530 had issues.
Oh my God! It was just, the only thing I liked about the 1520 was the camera and the screen size. In any case, I think at this point the only saving grace for the Windows 10 Mobile platform, and assuming that Panos Panay is going to deliver the quote unquote Surface phone, is that there is some sort of miracle that the world falls in love with the universal Windows platform apps, the apps that can run via Continuum, such that you truly have to go back in time your pocket PC.
Do you know anybody that's actually writing one of those?
Universal Windows platform?
Yes.
Hulu just released. Netflix, I believe, is a UWP app.
Business, not consumer.
Oh, gosh, no. But don't forget, mobility is all driven by consumers. So if the consumers.
But no one buys a Windows phone. So the only place that I've seen Windows phone.
Nobody buys a Windows phone. Absolutely.
Except for IT shops in Europe. That's where I've seen Windows phone. IT, like corporate paid, paid devices, specifically in Europe, have gone surprisingly Windows phone.
So some of the customers of CSC have gone Windows as well, but because they're big Microsoft shops. But you're absolutely
right. That's what I mean.
It's a gross minority.
And so the only way that the universal Windows platform makes sense for anyone to do user experience on a small screen is for there to be a market for it. And so now you're down to that one region and those particular people and.
Let me ask a question. Number one, I happen to love Windows Phone OS, Windows Mobile, whatever, from the beginning. So I remember playing with Windows Phone 7, and I loved the tiles.
Yep.
Although I was sold something that wasn't there because the tiles weren't live. They didn't go live really till 8, although I was told they go live in 7 and 7.5. But it was truly different. It was really nice to see something that was different from iOS or Android, and as you got into Windows Phone 8, I liked the live tiles. I liked some of the things you could do with it. On the other hand, everything else was a crap show. And as much as I liked the device, I couldn't use it. And I look at where Microsoft is going now, where I get a better Outlook app on the iPhone than I do on Windows Phone.
It's embarrassing.
And on Android, I'm getting better Office apps. I'm getting pretty much a much better experience. And if you look at where, my take on this is when I look at where Microsoft is going, Microsoft is absolutely moving into services. And, the Nokia X Phone was, how do I do this on Android? Mm-hmm. And you see that there are now OEMs, now granted, they're not the big OEMs yet, who are licensing Office apps and putting them on the phone, who are putting Bing on the phone, who are actually replacing, it's Android, but it's Android only in name. At least it's starting to be there. And I want to start with Soren on this of, you're stepping out of mobile into networking, but you saw a lot of this in your last job at Mokana and your job before that. Where do you see this going? What are your thoughts?
I was just going to say that I think I like the whole, I mean, I agree with the whole discussion that Office apps, especially Outlook app, is better on Android and iOS than on Windows Phone. I haven't played with one, but I've seen many of my colleagues use a Windows Phone and how awful it looks on a Windows Phone than an iOS Android. If I have to kind of come to a conclusion as to where this is going or where I feel that this is going is Windows apps or Microsoft will become that kind of service provider for the existing install base. It's hard to uproot the Apple and Google users, the iOS and Android users. So instead of uprooting them with an entirely new device, I think, which to Philippe's points, didn't really work well with the device having so many stability issues to the extent now that Philippe is hard to take in the lack of instability. Microsoft will probably go with a service layer on top of the existing operating systems and become that kind of app provider and give the enterprise apps. Because even if going back to Brett's point about the IT shops purchasing the Windows phones in a specific region, it makes sense for Microsoft to go down that path to strengthen their apps and the user experience on the different operating systems, than cater to that particular target segment in a specific region with a completely updated or brand new, even the phone form factor itself. So it makes it easier for them to just provide the service layer. But again, this is what I have seen it, and I've probably been out of touch of the mobile space at least for the past couple months. So if there's anything else that kind of alludes to Microsoft probably taking a different step, I probably am wrong.
So does this mean that universal apps really have no play in phone, but solve the issue that Androids had of we have phone apps for Android, we have stuff for Chrome, but we have nothing for tablet? And does universal apps really start, forget about phones and become, here's how we have an app that works both on a PC, mm-hmm. laptop, desktop, whatever, and it works on a tablet as well?
Yeah, but so two things. Yeah. First of all, a universal app is beyond the technicalities. All it means is that it's a responsive app, right? It changes UX based upon the form factor. So, but back to one of your original questions and comments to me, Brian, I'm going to quote Satya Nadella and say that I have an iPhone Pro. I just counted, I have 13 Microsoft apps on my iPhone 6S Pro.
Nice.
Pro. I have 5. I've got 5 for work.
And how many Google apps do you have?
I have the same. I have 2.
Yeah, I've got about 5.
I probably am an outlier here, but I have worked for smaller companies. I'm now heading into another smaller company. All my apps are Google apps. I have literally 0 Office apps on my phone or on any of my device. I don't even use OneNote anymore, which is my favorite Office application, because I just completely switched to Google Docs. I love the user experience or the UI of the Office online apps. It's exactly the way I've always been used to the Office apps traditionally, but now it's all Google Shop for me.
I have this theory that any company that was started since 2010 is a Google Shop, and any company, like 99% of companies that were formed before 2010 are Microsoft shops.
Hey, I think if you're talking startup and small, I would absolutely agree with that, because back then Google apps were free. Mm-hmm. Today they've started to charge for some of those, it's $5 or whatever it happens to be. But if you look at where Microsoft's gone to lower their price to match or make it the same and make it easy.
Well, biggest problem is universities, right? So you would, like, when I went to school way back in the dark ages of mobile anyway, there was a class on Office. Like, you learned how to do Office. There's no class for Google. You just show up and you know how to use it because you used it in high school or you did whatever.
Yeah. Oh, come on, Brett.
And then they're all popping out. But no, seriously.
That's also just the fact that there's ubiquitous IT knowledge at this point. You just have this natural understanding of technology at this point. I mean, my goodness, my 2-year-old knows how to use an iPad. We didn't have those kinds of things. That's part of why you don't have those classes.
Yeah. So but
at the same time, Microsoft still has a save button and Google doesn't, right? Because there's no point in having a save button anymore because that's an antiquated metaphor.
And yet I've lost documents on both.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's going to happen.
Is there a save button on word.com? Is there?
Actually, I don't think there is, but I have
don't
to
think
go
there
look.
Is either.
I don't know because nobody uses that, right? It's an interesting problem to solve, because when you use Google in school, then you pop out of school and you go to your first company and they hand you Office and you go, what is this, right? And
yeah, but Microsoft's also combating that by actually doing the exact same thing.
They are finally doing that. Yeah,
they're giving Office either for free or for an extremely low price to schools. But this will lead us. This is perfect timing. Leads us to our last topic, because we only have about 6-7 minutes left. And user experience. And I think this is great. We've actually already started this. And I can hear from the audio comments in the background from the three of you that you're chomping at the bit. But, we've all been in mobile for years now. We've seen user experience and everything else and what it means in consumer. Why is there no user experience in enterprise?
Because what's the return on investment of user experience?
If you don't do it, it's shadow IT.
Yeah, no, I know, but that's the first question that you get from IT executives that haven't moved to the new world, that don't understand that adoption is optional. They're still living in the world where IT is a monolith and a dictator and says, here is the thing, you're going to use this, you have no choice, goodbye. That's their mentality. And in fact, I just had this discussion with a client yesterday, and I said, I challenged them, and I said, because they said, well, security and user experience are on the two sides of a seesaw. And I said, the best thing to ever happen to user experience is Touch ID and certificates, but primarily Touch ID. So you can do both, but that's a hard thing to understand.
Well, this goes back to some IT departments that I have experience with have said, for our consumer-facing apps, yeah, we'll go native. And for our employees, we'll do HTML5 because that's good enough. Well, what they're basically saying, what they're explicitly saying is that their employees are second-class citizens as compared to their customers or prospects.
Now, granted, they're explicitly saying that, but I think it's hard for them to admit as well because they see, I think to Brett's point, they see a higher return of investment in their consumer-facing or the external user-facing apps than their employee-facing apps. I mean, even I've been in the mobile space. I mean, we've all been in this space for a while. And how many times have we seen an expense reporting app, our favorite app, our expense reporting app being mobilized to the best or to the best possible user experience for the internal users. But when it comes to an end user facing app, like a customer facing app, it obviously comes as a first priority. It's all about how much money am I spending in developing these apps or maintaining these apps versus how much am I going to get back on these apps or how much am I going to save? How important is the user experience for my internal users? And I think I completely agree with you, Philip, that most times employees, if not all the times, are second-class citizens because that is a group of users that do not get them the highest return on investment. But little do they know that employees also have this kind of return where if it bleeds into many areas. One, obviously, adoption and the shadow IT. And the second is the security of the data itself. Now, the data starts leaking in multiple different directions. Could be other apps, other insecure apps, or off-the-shelf apps that the employees are using. It can cause repercussions, and the ripple effect is intense, but I don't think the direct return is calculated that way.
Agreed. So to paraphrase Mark Benioff of Salesforce.com, if you take care of your employees, they will take care of your customers. And in turn, that will take care of the stock price.
And if you don't understand that your employees are your customers too, you've already lost the battle. Absolutely. And you need to look no further than the CEO. I guarantee, who was the first person in with an iPhone? Someone in the C-suite. Probably the CEO because they got it as a president or whatever else. But how many of them probably tried to use Outlook when it was actually a Compli and it came out and they said, you know what? I hate this. I need a better way of accessing my mail. They either picked a Compli, they picked Boxer, they picked Nacho Cove. Didn't matter what they picked. They picked an app that wasn't what the corporate IT wanted them to use.
Right.
You can start from there and look at it and say, and yet you can't convince them that you can securely do user experience.
So interesting kind of parallel to that. So this morning I was talking to another client who is evaluating Office 365, and they said, and I quote, it's not secure enough to be able to connect to Office 365 directly. We are going to force all of our users to VPN into our corporate network and then go back out to Office 365.
Okay.
And I say, well,
where public clouds are typically going to be more secure than whatever you as an individual is doing because of the multi-tenancy factors.
So I asked, why do you want to take this approach? And they said, well, we've always done it this way. So number one, biggest red flag for Brett Belding is we've always done it this way. Number two is we don't care about the user experience. If they want their email, this is what they have to do. period. That was the end of it. So now I need to go and convince them that this isn't the way to do it. But the fact that that conversation happened that way is the reason why we still have user experience discussions at all, because people still think that way.
And that's what leads to shadow IT. I like to call it shadow innovation, because if you take the time to see what your users are doing, half the time those scenarios can be made or can be done securely. And you can use a new app and secure it and everything else and actually make it work the way you want it to work.
You know, the other interesting part about user experience that we forget about because we like to talk about technology is support. And Apple kind of pioneered the Genius Bar concept, is essentially a digital concierge of sorts. And that goes a long way, right? Making your IT people not hide behind do not reply at it.com or whatever their email address is, right? Putting faces on it, putting people in the lobbies or in the cafeterias, all of those things, they affect the user experience. And the easier things are, the cheaper they are to support. And that's really how you drive user experience, right? One side is adoption, because if it's easy to use, people are going to use it. The other side is if it's easy to use, it's not going to cost you much to support it, because nobody's going to be calling in saying, how do I use this extremely complicated thing? I don't have to build training materials because it's intuitive. It just works.
So in that same vein, let me tell you an experience with I will not name the company, but the SLA for internal help desk to actually speak to a human being is approximately 80 to 90 minutes. If you want expedited service, you actually need to use Internet Explorer 6.
Oh, my God.
Okay, for chat. And one person, they were telling me their computer completely died. I mean, it's dead, right? It can't fix it. Motherboard fried, not worth putting all that money. To get this person a new computer is going to take, hopefully, 3 weeks.
Wow.
So what are they going to do instead?
They don't know. They literally don't know.
No, what's the end user going to do?
The end user does not know what the heck they're going to do.
So IT is not providing them a solution. And it's interesting. I mean, the philosophical debate is, how much do I care about my job, right? Do I want to then bring my own laptop, break all of the IT things, and still get my job done? Or do I want to say, look, you're not providing me the tools necessary to do my job, so I'm not doing my job?
Well, let's do the question right here. We've all worked for corporations and we've all worked for smaller companies. How many times have you used your own devices, whether you were supposed to or not?
So here at CSC, I only, other than the first 2 weeks where I had not yet gotten my MacBook Air, and where I did have to use Lotus Notes on iNotes, basically, for the first 2 weeks. Other than that, I've always used my corporate-provided laptop, my corporate-provided smartphone, and tablet for work. There are some pretty important policies here, especially with some of our clients that are in highly regulated industries, where I want to make sure that there are absolutely unquestionable and undeniably zero issues in terms of security and policy.
Brett?
So I have done BYOD at every company I've worked for. I was one of the first actually to do – I brought my own BlackBerry at IBM and at Cisco before the policy was put in place, because for one of those roles, I didn't qualify to have my bill paid. And I said, well, if I pay it all and bring it all, then can I hook it up? And that was a shock to a bunch of people, because they didn't – they were wondering why I was going to pay for something for work. And I said, well, I want it. I'm going to use it. So just let me hook it up and that's all you got to do. So on the laptop side, it's been, 90 plus percent corporate. I'll use a personal laptop for if I have to do something in a pinch, but usually the laptop's corporate, but all the rest of it, the smartphones in particular have all been personal. Tablets are sort of a mix.
Swarna?
Phones have always been both ways. I probably preferred to use my personal phone all the time. In only one of my previous jobs, I used a corporate phone because I used to travel internationally. So it just made more sense to just go with the company's roaming policies. Laptops, it's interesting because I've worked at larger and smaller companies. I've worked at smaller companies that had a huge no-no kind of policy for BYOD. They strictly did not want any employees to bring their own personal laptops, but personal phones were okay, and accessing corporate data on personal phone was completely okay with them. I also worked at larger companies where they could really care less for about the device that you would access your data on, and much more important was your VM or your virtual desktop that you had that you were going to access on that device. So I worked at both ends, where I feel much more productive, mainly because I get my way, is when corporations or the employers give you the flexibility. We will give you the option of both corporate owned or personally owned. It's up to you. Then you pick and choose. It feels like I've made a decision and now I'm taking the responsibility of owning up to my decision. So that's just me.
Understood. I mean, I can say that I've done both, sometimes legally, sometimes illegally, as far as the corporate rules. And, you know, I've also had situations where, and actually I was with a bunch of you when one of these happened, my laptop got left at home. I was giving a keynote presentation at a conference. My laptop did not make it into my bag and I still had to do some work.
Yep.
And, you know, the cool thing was I was able to do the work. I was able to do the presentation and I borrowed somebody's laptop. I actually borrowed my daughter's laptop for about 20 minutes and everything else I did on my iPad. And I was able to do it. And, you know, that's the cool thing of experiences, being able to go across multiple pieces. But we've used up all our time because I did promise to be done by now. So first of all, I want to thank all you guys for being on the first episode of the third season. Thank you, Brett. Thank you, Swarna. Thank you, Philippe.
Thank you.
And we will be having a bunch of episodes coming from Mobile World Congress. And we're going to do a couple more of these roundtables during the season. But thank you all. And we'll be back soon.